Okay, it is now 5:30, so I'm going to go ahead and call our joint Columbia City Council joint work session with our Planning Commission. It's Monday, July 24th, 2023. I think we'll start with introductions. I'm trying to pull up the agenda, so thanks for having it right up there for me, Pat. So let's go ahead and do introductions. I will start Barbara Buffalo, Mayor of Columbia, Missouri. I'll go to my left.
Andrea Wehner, Second Ward Council.
Don Waterman, Ward 5.
Zach Dunn, Planning and Zoning.
Michael McMahon, Planning and Zoning.
Valerie Carroll, Planning and Zoning.
Sarah Lowe, Planning and Zoning.
Sharon Galley-Jones, Chair of Planning and Zoning.
Pat Zenner, Development Services Manager.
Matt Ford, Planning and Zoning.
Peggy Fleischer, Planning and Zoning.
Rod DeCarlin Seawood, City Manager.
Betsy Peter, 6th Ward City Council.
Joy Lovelady, 3rd Ward.
Nick Knuth, 1st Ward.
All right, thank you, and thanks for asking for us to come together, because I know you all had a report on our June 5th meeting, which had some of the feedback from the public engagement, and after next couple work sessions, we're like, let's have some clarifications on what direction council wants to go. So in the council report that you all sent to us, you have some questions, but do you have a general discussion that you wanted to start with before getting into those questions?
I just had a couple things. We had our Planning and Zoning Commission meeting last Thursday. That was unfortunately not in time to put in the written report that's on the agenda, kind of the result of that work session. We want to say that we looked at the engagement tool. We don't think it's useful when we talk about the overall results, but we did read all of the comments and appreciated being able to get actual comments, and thank you to the council for forwarding as well the comments that you've been getting over the time. We went through the language again last Thursday. We think we need to clarify when we say how many days we're talking about, that that's the days that it's actually rented, not just that it's advertised. And we also think that having this middle ground of secondary residences is causing a lot of confusion, so we want to consolidate and just say, is it your primary residence or isn't? There are only going to be two levels. And we think that will provide some simplification. Other than that, we feel pretty good about where we are in the process and just want to hear from y'all what changes you would like to see, if any. And then we can finish the public engagement and get a vote or two.
Yeah, Nick.
So the changes you're talking about, those would go into the draft.
They would go into the draft after legal goes through and helps us figure out what exactly that needs to look like. So what will come to you as city council will have those changes in it. What we actually take a public vote on will have those changes in it. But we haven't written the language yet.
Any other clarifying questions on that piece right there? Because I'm trying to get my head up. I think I had just a couple of questions. From what was included based on the report you all sent out. One of the things that we talked about, it talks about in the report, is in December 2020, council asked for a simplified ordinance. And I was wondering, like, do we think this is it? General overarching comment question.
I will say there are a lot fewer use-specific standards, restrictions, reporting requirements, that sort of thing, in this draft than there were in the original ordinance that came out of Planning and Zoning. So it is certainly simpler, and I think consolidating Tier 2 and Tier 3 a little bit will make it even more clear what we're trying to do.
This is much simpler than the last one we saw.
The December 2020 with the 15 amendments one, okay.
Yeah, this is much clearer.
Okay. And then another question, I don't have to have all the questions. I just happen to be having a question.
You're ready?
Okay. One of the other questions that I had was, where's my one thing that I had? When we were talking about, in the sample, the survey that we sent out, and you guys clarified that you weren't really happy with the survey questions. I don't know if you came to a resolution last Thursday, but the question was regulations that preservation of affordable housing could have been more clarified on what we meant by that. Did you all talk about that? Like in the survey, it said something like, would you support this with more regulations for affordable housing, or would you support more regulations for affordable housing?
I mean, I don't think we got into a lot of depth about what we would like the survey to have looked like. I think that we were more concerned with the administration of it. I mean, yes, the questions could have been done differently depending on what you're trying to get, and a temperature taking tool is fine. BHERD was incredibly hard to register for. This was one of the first surveys, may have been the first one that went out on it. So there were some problems with that. I know that I personally wasn't even able to get registered because I never got a confirmation email to do that whole part of the process on BHERD. So, I mean, I think, I don't know really what you're asking other than...
If you had an idea, it was more about if you had an idea about what either in Pat, this might be for you, if we as staff or staff had an idea about what they...
Well, what I would suggest is that the purpose for the question was really to try to gauge general public sentiment associated with the idea and the concept, which was one of the underlying questions that was asked when we did research. It was the loss of affordable housing.
Right.
And so it is a generic question. I'm not going to deny that the questions could have been worded better. But really was, you know, do you support preservation of affordable housing, owner-occupied or rental within the city? That was the question. And out of the responses, you know, 321 people said yes. So there is a value. It's a value-laden question. Now, how do we achieve affordable housing preservation within a short-term rental regulation? That's a question, and that's one of the elements that goes into the regulation. And that, to some extent, supports some of the research that the commission has done as it relates to the concentrations of where we have short-term rentals in wards 1 and 3. And how do we then look at that, and how do we try to make sure that we're not losing those additional housing units off of the market? So what we wanted to sense was, is that an issue that people are concerned about? Affordable housing, period, in the city of Columbia is an issue. Affordable housing lost to short-term rental is not the way that we ask the question.
I'm not exactly sure how we're going to proceed here, but so I may be out of order.
I think they have 8 questions that they kind of want clarifying. Okay. We're going to probably go council by council. But I think right now it's kind of like this general overarching questions and intent and ideas and next step. Then we'll go to the next step, Simeon.
Well, I'll go ahead and ask it, and we may get back to it. But I know that you looked at STR regs and a number of other cities comparable to us, I assume. So I think everybody's been late to the game on this because everyone was taken by surprise about how quickly STRs took hold. We're later to the game. So there's probably opportunity to learn from missteps of others. So I'm wondering if you had any general sense of what we want to be careful, I hate to put it this way, be careful to avoid or careful to be sure we do, either way. In the process of putting this together?
Yeah, I think that we did. We looked at a lot of different cities, and I know that here in Missouri, Kansas City just completely redid theirs to make it more similar to where we're going. They originally had a system where you had to get permission for every individual unit, you had to get letters from your neighbors, etc., and they estimated they had a 10% compliance rate. And so that's kind of why we are looking at, when we're talking about principal residences, where you're wanting to rent out some portion of your primary residence, we want that to be as simple, as straightforward, as easy as possible, because that's kind of the original idea. When we're talking about people who are making it a business, if they are making it a business, they should be able to do some level of regulatory upkeep and compliance. And so we're less concerned about that end. But that's, we're trying to look at practicalities and how can we make sure that this is something that both achieves the goals that we are trying to achieve that were in the report from back in December, but that also will actually be enforceable and people can actually comply with. Which again is why we think getting rid of that weird secondary residence rule is probably a good idea.
Glad you mentioned enforcement and compliance. This is the question for staff. In a system that's in the draft ordinance, the suggestion is kind of before us. What is the demand on staff for this? Like, what additional, how many additional staff would we need to, there's an additional compliance, additional permitting, and then also, is it complaint-driven follow-ups? Like, what would be?
So, what I would tell you probably at a minimum is we would need at least two.
This is pretending you're fully staffed right now.
Well, but yes, and that's my response is based upon a full staff. It's going to require probably at a minimum two, and then it's going to require outside agency or outside consultancy support under an annual contract that deals with the scraping services, booking calendar evaluation, and the like. We would most likely be doing licensure, the licensure component, the actual physical licensure component of it, initial inspection, and then depending on how the structure were set up, it would either be follow-up on enforcement, because most of the agencies that are companies that we have done some initial 10,000 foot overviews with offer those services. So I think a tolerance level of how much do we want to farm out determines how many on-site staff and bodies you want. Because we are going to need to be responsive in the way of enforcement, and that may be, you know, an on-call individual on weekends, starting on a Friday night, manning a hotline, which many of these companies also offer, and so they're routed. Complaints are routed. But this is I hate to use the cliche term of it takes a village. We are going to have to, in essence, unify internally for support cross-departmentally, but we also will likely need the assistance of the public to help report. And what I have gathered in my interactions with folks is they do not want to assist. A lot of people are uncomfortable doing that because they don't want to create enemies with their neighbors. And that's understandable, but the only way an effective enforcement process works is we have to know the issues, but we also have to be able to be responsive, and we have to be decisive once those issues have been reported. And I think to Mr. Foster's issues in a deeper discussion with one of these firms, the way that we do enforcement, you have to structure that properly so the public knows, you know, one, two, or three strikes, and there is a consequence associated with that. And there are examples of how those work in other jurisdictions that have probably a much more intense short-term rental market that has those problems. But again, our first step here is find out where all of them are through a registration process. Once we have that, we have the tool, at least then, to go the next step. But it's going to be, at a minimum, it'd be two. That would be probably out of the Community Development Department at this point. Business licensing may need an additional staff member as well, so you could possibly see three on the onset plus consulting costs, all of which the fee structure would be most likely paying for, along with possible revenue income coming in.
Right.
Yeah, Tom. Question from your comments earlier when you were talking about the structure of the questions and so on, and it almost sounded to me like you were approaching this from an either or. Short-term rentals or affordable housing. Is that a correct assumption, or were you looking at more of a both and?
I think, Mr. Stan, your seat's here. There wasn't a whole lot of thought, let me put it that way first, but I think you have to look at it from both perspectives. And I think that goes, again, to Ms. Carroll and Ms. Lowe's research as it relates to where are we seeing concentrations and how do you balance the locationally based on the research that was done. It's not surprising that Ward 3 and Ward 1 had higher concentrations of short-term rental by single owner. They're nearest the attractions. And then as we radiate out from the city, they become less. Well, I think part of what we have to strategize as you develop a set of regulations is either how do you deal with that issue, that phenomenon? And you know, there are multiple ways to do that. You can, in some ordinances that we have evaluated, there are districts. So you establish district-related standards, not zoning district, but district, like an entertainment district. Or you handle it in a different fashion. So affordable housing is one issue, and the loss of housing to short-term rental that may have been affordable is another issue. And I don't think that we have not been able to get to the aspect of the deeper question of how much housing that has been converted was actually either A, previously rental property that was affordable possibly, or B, that had fallen into disrepair and that if left available for rental, would it be affordable after it was repaired and restored to a livable condition? That's information that I don't recall us being able to dive deep enough into. However, Ms. Lowe and Ms. Carroll can respond to that since they did that research.
And I will just say that we as a commission were looking at it as, is there an impact? And if so, how do we lessen the impact? Not just on affordable housing as that term is used in, you know, the housing development department, but attainable housing, housing that people can actually afford to live in. Not necessarily low-income housing. And our suspicion, just based on the data that we are able to go through, is that there is an impact not only on availability, but also on overall housing costs, including the cost to buy a starter home, which in Columbia is now no longer starter home pricing. So that's, I think that's probably why staff included it. It's something that's definitely been on the commission's mind as we went through and wrote this language. But I don't think it's an either or proposition. I think it's a, how do these two things interact and how can we lessen the impact? This is not the only problem with housing in Columbia. This is not a silver bullet to fix housing in Columbia, but it's certainly one of the many factors. We're also, as I think you all know, looking at cottage standards, small lot standards. I think right now there's a contract out on for a consultant to look at non-conforming lots and how to do infill development better. All these things contribute, but I think it would be incorrect to say that short-term rentals don't have any impact on the cost and availability of housing.
I'm not saying they have no impact.
Yeah, I know, but I don't think it's either or. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, and as far as the affordable housing, like you said, cottage, small lots, maybe we also need, I know I'm digressing a bit, multifamily, you know, two- and three-unit townhouses rather than individual single-unit residences. So that kind of seems to be where everybody's hung up on, but again, we could do the townhouse. We don't need the apartment, high-rise apartment, but anyway.
I love a good brownstone.
I digress.
Nick, and then...
Can you clarify for us what zoning, based off this draft, does not permit an STR?
So STRs of some kind are allowed in all zoning districts. They are more restricted in residential, but if it is your primary residence, you can have an STR in residential. You can have it without asking permission up to 120 days, and that's rented, not just offered. So if you rent it out every weekend for 3 days a weekend, that's 52 times three. So you're getting close to your 120 days, assuming you're totally filled. You may go over. If you do want to go over 120 days on your primary residence, you get a CUP, probably won't be a problem, but just come and ask for it. If you are not in a primary residence, so if it is your second home, it's an investor property, whatever, you can only be in the commercial zones. I think, and this is where we're consolidating things, and so some of this may change. I believe you can get a CUP up to 120 days in residential, but again, that's where we're kind of looking at how do we consolidate that, because we had allowed that for secondary residences. I also want to point out that commercial zoning includes the MDT, which is where a lot of the... business-owned STRs are currently located.
So just to clarify again, make sure I'm interpreting what you're saying correctly. So an STR can happen in R1 as easily and as equally as it could happen in R2.
R1 and R2 are not treated differently. Okay. The only thing that's treated differently in the residential zones is RMH, manufactured housing, and I think we do not allow them and manufactured housing.
Yep.
Yeah. But other than that, all the residential zones are treated the same.
And to clarify from last week's meeting, you're talking about combining Tier 2 and Tier 3. Is
yes.
that correct? So then the ones that would be in the accessory dwelling districts would be one of the ones where it's qualified for?
It would
or
only be primary residences that would be an accessory use.
Okay.
And accessory dwelling units, the way that we have it
written. Yeah, I was like, walk me through that, like, sort
yeah.
of case study. Let's
yeah.
say I own a house, but I built a really cool little mom and pop,
no
whatever
problem.
They're called, in my backyard.
If, assuming it's a legally built ADU.
But
it
will be
assuming,
legally
built. Right.
Yeah.
We're going to be doing some drive-bys.
Right.
No. Assuming that you have a legally built ADU, you can get your short-term rental certificate for that ADU.
Okay.
You can't have two certificates
like
on the same address property,
okay.
but you can still get your one. Yeah.
Okay. Just, wait, hold on.
Well,
this other
it touches on what you just said.
Okay.
You go with but in that scenario, again, just throwing things
uh-huh.
out there, you could have a traditional rental and this ADU be an STR.
If you are renting out that house, then it's not your primary residence, and you'll have to get a CUP and go through all that. It'll be treated like it's an investment property, not your primary residence. If it's your primary residence, you're fine.
Do you want to clarify?
Okay.
You can ask them. Okay. You don't have
to. Just going back to what was said before about where current STRs are, Mr. Center mentioned 1 and 3 is where most of them are, and that's what the research data shows. I can understand how that might be partly because they're closer, but there's a lot of housing close in Ward 4 as well, downtown.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if there aren't other reasons, and you mentioned that about how starter homes are lower priced homes are ones that are brought into this process and bought for the purpose of STRs. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I will say it's the ones that are not owner occupied that are primarily in 1 and 3. Ward 4 has a significant number. Most of them are owner occupied.
Right.
In fact, for that, most of, well, I guess not most of the units, most of the owners own only one. Which would indicate that it's probably. Do we want to go through?
No, I have another. Sorry.
Okay,
we have
sorry.
All these clarifying questions.
We'll ask all the clarifying ones.
Well, when I was looking at the definitions, I was trying to, when I look at designated agent, and I probably should have started this with a poll of how many people have stayed in Airbnb, but I won't do that. But when it talks about designated agent as being somebody located within the city of Columbia, when looking at other cities' regulations, have any of them done things about locally owned, you know what I mean, like owner? What was the conversation there?
Some of them include the regulation that the owner cannot be out of town while the place is being rented. New York City, I think, is actually going through a lawsuit right now because they require the owner to be on property the entire time. We didn't want to go that far. But a lot of cities do say you have to have.
Wait, what? Oh, you mean of a secondary residence?
Of anything. So, like, you would have
where
to.
Where are they staying?
Exactly. Yes. Which
okay.
is why there's a lawsuit.
Okay. I just meant more of, like, outside people coming in and buying
right.
properties here and renting.
No, I think that most cities have some requirement for there to be someone who is 24/7 available to come and deal with problems. And that's so that we don't have the problem that we've been having now, where if there is a party house on your block, you call the police, and the police are like, it's not the owner. You call neighborhood services, and neighborhood services is like, well, the problem's gone now because those people left town. This way, there is a 24/7 actual person who can go and respond and say, you just broke the terms of your contract or whatever, who can answer those kinds of calls and be responsible. That's what we're trying to achieve, and a lot of other cities do that.
Blinked on it. No. Oh, came back to me. Unless I'm mistaken, it didn't seem like there was any consideration given within the proposal. I'm sure, I would assume it was discussed, to grandfathering in those already in existence that would be, you know, beyond
yeah.
the limits in terms of licensors?
We talked about it quite a bit. We were directed by legal that that is not something that we can do because that is not a currently operating business. So currently, everyone who has an STR in Columbia is breaking our ordinances. Right. They're not allowed to do that. So we were told by legal that we can't give them preferential treatment in the same way we would if it were a current legal activity and we're taking away the legality of it, then we could do it. But because they aren't, we're treating two people that are essentially the same, but one of them was breaking the law before, and so we're giving them preferential treatment, and that will create different legal problems. So we were directed that we could not.
And I would suggest that the question that is asked for this evening's conversation is do you want us to identify a manner in which, as long as we are equally treating those that are presently operating the same way that somebody else would be operating in the future under regulation, that is one method, and that is something that the law department has indicated. We have to make sure that you have equal application of the law. Currently, anybody that is operating in the city of Columbia is operating unlawfully. It is not a recognized land use in our code, and so this ordinance will create a path for particular individuals to become legally compliant under the code. But if, in fact, you are wanting to address the issue of those that cannot, short of what this ordinance suggests that the year period of time allows that property owner to do with their property, we have to create a system by which legally we are creating equal application, and it is addressing the general objective. And what I would tell you is that I think most ordinances that at least I have evaluated have a provision within them. Now, I think to Mr. Foster or Mr. Waterman's comment earlier, you know, we were taken by storm with the increasing demand for short-term rentals through the Airbnb platform. But all of you have been around long enough, most likely, to remember Vrbo. You know, vacation rentals have existed for decades, and they have existed in this town for decades. And therefore, I think part of what we may need to be considering is a way of bringing them in under the tent, so to speak, and then applying the same set of requirements that we would have to apply to anybody violating our ordinance in order to be able to deal with that.
I can jump in really quick, too. I think, so the way that this is structured right now, there's going to be certain structures of a short-term rental that are going to be allowed by right in particular zoning.
Becky, can you also say who you are?
Yeah, so I'm Becky Thompson, Assistant City Councilor.
Thank you.
There will be some under the way that the ordinance is currently drafted that if they want to be in a residential zoning district, they have to get the CUP. There will be some scenarios, for instance, the way that it's currently drafted, that will never be allowed in a residential zone, which is like a short-term rental if you want to rent it more than 120 days. Right now, that's not going to be authorized in any residential zone. So if you get to that point and you say, okay, there's X number of existing STRs that will never be able to, that won't be able to exist after this ordinance is passed and you want to create a platform for them, I think one option would be to just widening our CUP process and allow more people to come on in under our conditional use process. That would be applicable to both currently existing and in the future.
Becky, can you walk council through a little bit about the CUP process and like what all is included in that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have a specific procedure in Chapter 29 right now for the CUP process. If you want to get a CUP,
say what a CUP is.
A conditional use permit. So certain uses require a conditional use permit to be able to operate in a particular zoning. They go through the Planning and Zoning Commission and they come to City Council. The nice thing with the CUP process is it also gives the Commission and Council the ability to add additional conditions to something if they think that's appropriate given the contextual nature of the neighborhood or other factors of that particular use. And so this would allow certain short-term rentals to be able to be operated by right, and then other scenarios which are permitted as part of that process and to give Commission and Council the ability to have some input and to look at the particulars of maps of that operation and of the surrounding characteristics and see whether it's appropriate or not.
Thank you for that. Yeah. Any questions for Vic? Yeah, Don.
A couple of questions. When you say that current STRs are illegal under ordinance, is it a specific ordinance, or is it simply because the existing ordinance do not say you may?
That is the correct statement.
That's correct. It's been the city's position that it's not currently a permitted use, and therefore,
okay.
And we went so far, City Council went so far as to, I think, twice pass a stay of enforcement. So people should have been on notice that what they were doing was illegal, but any enforcement of that activity was stayed.
And we were...
I don't remember the date.
The last stay was...
It expired,
so...
Yeah,
so,
it expired
so,
a year ago.
So everybody understands, I mean... We have been in the state of developing the regulations, and therefore enforcement has been because of the short-term nature of a short-term rental, establishing a record by which to do prosecution is almost impossible. And so based upon the stay, and we've had discussions of reestablishing the stay, it was chosen to just continue to work through this process at this juncture without having that formal process. Now, what I will tell you is we get contacted quite frequently by individuals that are looking to invest. We warn them. We advise them that we are in the process of regulations. We provide them the regulations that are being considered. We cannot control what one individual generally does with their property. Now, we do have a long-term rental program, and we have that's a very established procedure. While it does not grant anybody a right to utilize their property as a short-term rental, it does afford the city an opportunity to at least have health and safety inspections on the property. It does also identify that it is registered within the long-term system. I would suggest that we have a number of long-term rentals that are possibly going on either side of the long and the short term. And so anything that is greater than 30 days in rental duration is considered a long-term rental at that point. And this ordinance does not address the duality of licensure, but the duality of licensure would apply. And this is why, as Ms. Galway-Jones pointed out, you can list your property for 365 days a year. The amount of rental revenue you can receive off of it as a short-term rental is as specified in the code. But you can utilize, for the other two-thirds of the year, a long-term rental. You may have a traveling professor. You may have a traveling nurse. You may do a 90-day lease. And that would be a permissible use in the shoulder times that you're not using it for a short-term rental. That is what the idea was.
And that, so just to clarify, that is in the proposal in front of us.
Yes.
I know that was a concern that we got in some of the messages to us,
yeah.
Was the concern about the lack of affordable or attainable rental housing. Stock because they're being potentially switched over.
So if you have a 90-day rental for a traveling nurse, this doesn't apply to you. If you have a six-week rental for someone who's here for cancer treatments, this doesn't apply to you. If you have a weekend stay, it does. So, and I think that's caused some confusion as well, because I've talked to a lot of people who say, oh, you know, I want to rent on, or I want to advertise on Nurse B&B, and I'm like, great, those contracts are more than 30 days. You just need a long-term rental certificate. This is talking about people who are staying for less than 30 days in a row. And that's when this kicks in. So I'm guessing a lot of people will have two certificates, one for short-term rental and one for long-term rental.
It'll be up for staff to check for compliance.
Well, yeah. Hence that's when we talk about what it takes. So you have... The private industry that has this has access, because of proprietary purposes, they have access to calendars, booking calendars, and that is how you're verifying what that particular property is receiving in rental income on a short-term rental. Now, the long-term rental side of it, as long as we're capturing short-term, how that property is otherwise being used is probably of a lesser concern of ours, because A, we're not collecting lodging taxes on it at that point, which is another component of this whole process. And B, it's part of the long-term rental process. So it's, we've already got a license for that. We already have it inspected for other purposes. The short-term rental, which has got the tie-in of the accommodations taxes associated with it, is why you need to monitor booking calendars as well as the other regulatory provisions. Once you reach that particular threshold, should there be a date threshold established, it's at that point then that either the consultant or the firm that we're utilizing to help manage that component, that administrative component, is notifying the property owner. But they're not stopping to evaluate the booking calendar of those parcels, of those properties. So if they're continuing to book in excess of their allotment per their licensure, they're in violation. Mm-hmm. And the enforcement component of the ordinance, which is what I hear frequently, where is the back end? Well, the back end of the ordinance hasn't been developed yet, which is the enforcement and the administrative component, because we don't know what piece of the front end we're adopting. So once we figure out the front end side of it, then we figure out the administrative components, the enforcement and the penalties, and how the staff interacts with this process. It has always been understood internally that the long-term rental procedure that we utilize, this will in essence be tacked onto it like a caboose. It'll have a slightly different set of procedures to follow, but it is the same general process because we already have that in play.
And we're really trying hard not to invade licensing and taxation, because that's not our charge. Our charge is land use. Mm-hmm. And so I know it's a little bit frustrating because people are like, well, what's the form going to look like? What are the fines going to be? Who's going to do? That's not Planning and Zoning Commission's role. So we're trying to say this is what will be allowed and not allowed, and then next will come the other chapters that legal and staff will have to figure out. That.
Is there one over here? Yeah, Don.
My second question, bear with me because I'm late to the party, newly elected, obviously, was in the group that helped put the current iteration together of the ordinance, the draft, who made up that group? Was it strictly planning and zoning and the city? Was there any inclusion of hoteliers, short-term rental owners, a small contingent, so that we could come up with something, a compromise to, you know, work with as many people as we could to make this work?
So I know there were several people who attended most of our work sessions. We did not get comments. We got comments from some of them, but not all of them, as the process was ongoing. And I know the ones that I saw were certainly taken into account and considered as we were doing the drafting. Something that was slightly frustrating is, despite knowing that people were watching that process and attending those meetings, we really didn't start getting substantive comments until after we put out the draft. And I mean, all of our meetings are public. None of this was happening behind closed doors. You know, Pat's very good about passing along to us comments as he gets them. There was really not a lot of feedback given to us until we put out this draft.
I understand that, but my, you know, working with my attorney on getting some affairs in order, and, you know, as he said, okay, now we move from the abstract to a draft. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it's, you know, once you see it in draft form, then it's a little easier to see, okay,
sure,
this is exactly where we've gotten to, yeah, these are the points, and that rather than, you know,
and we've been collecting that as we go.
Yeah.
Okay. Commissioner Stanton, did you want
to
add?
In addition to Madam Chair, I've been part of the process.
Okay.
Yes.
3 years ago.
Yes.
So what you're seeing is not the first original draft concerning this issue. This is probably the second or third, and the second and third process fully cycled through. So from the beginning, yes, we had the input. We had public hearings that lasted for hours. We had emails. We had input. We digested that. We came up with drafts. It got kicked back. We had feedback again. So this is the simmering of the sauce, the product, the third simmering, I would even say. So I feel like we've had not only the long-term experience and growing with the industry, but also growing with the opinions as the industry has developed we have been able to capture and grow with the public opinion of it too. So this is the product of 3 years of input.
Mr. Waterman, to your question specifically,
yeah.
So drafting ordinances generally is an in-house project. There needs to be an opportunity for the commission to put onto paper, after discussion with staff, what is the objective. The public hearing process that we go through and the engagement processes we go through are generally the byproduct of the ordinance as it's been generated. It is not normally something that is a real-time process where we are having folks that are attending and expecting to be basically inserting in their ideas into the ordinance. The commission has drafted the ordinances that have been prepared. I hate to use the term in a vacuum, but that is the best way to describe it. It is somewhat in a cocoon because they are dealing with issues internally, the what-ifs, and what they believe to be the most appropriate way to approach based on the research and based on what staff's bringing back to them technically.
Pat, and I'm going to bring you down. Okay, two seconds.
Yeah. So we have no intention of generating an ordinance that does not have public engagement associated with it, and that goes to Mr. Stanton's point. The first time we went through this, we had, if I'm not incorrect, four-hour work sessions, public listening sessions, to which the ordinance was revised from. And what we're here for is to try to be able to obtain what it is that council is receptive to having brought forward to public hearing. It's the public hearing comments that may impact the nine commissioners to make revisions, but they also need to understand what it is that the commission or the council is wanting. And so the public would like to hear that probably as well, because we're trying to basically get an ordinance that's going to go from one venue to the next with as little change.
Thank you.
A couple more clarifying questions, and then we'll get into the list.
And this may be more a question for Carlin, because it's finances. Part of our goal here was to get the lodging tax from the SCRs, and my understanding is that tax goes and helps fund CVB.
Mm-hmm.
So what's funding this process? What's helping fund two new staff members?
It will have to come from... partially come from the whatever the tax is,
fines and applications,
whatever
fees or whatever.
Yes,
which certainly won't be enough.
Right, and yeah. I think that's going to be part of the evaluation, because I don't think we've gotten to that process of administration and enforcement, and what does that look like, and what do you need in order to do that.
And I also saw several times in this draft referenced something along the lines of at the end of a long statement of say, and or subject to the Director of Community Development. Is this staying within the community development, or is it going to be going to our new housing and whatever the full name is?
Most likely it will stay with community development.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, so we have a few questions that Planning and Zoning had put in the report that they had sent out to us. I'm going to read them quickly and then kind of go through this with y'all. So first one of the things... what Pat just said. They want to know from council your desired objectives on the subject, right? Like, I assume that means, you know, what are your concerns, but what objective do you want at the end of the day sort of thing, right? And then you have your list of questions, which you have up there as well, which is you're basically asking almost like a either yes or no or respond to the eight, is it just eight? Yeah. Eight questions that we have before us, which are asking some of the clarifying things about whether or not we're supportive of, we have clarifying questions about, which we got to some in our questions, about limiting them in certain districts, the investor-owned discussion, what about the number of them, which I can't imagine you going out and counting, total number of days, though, advertise all of those. So to start with, though, the overarching kind of the desired objectives on this subject, does anyone want to go first? Otherwise, I'm comfortable with saying my own thoughts on this.
Are we just going by one by one up there?
No, well, first I went overall objective.
Okay.
So I'll just say, like, for mine, my overall objective is that we have something in place that is making whatever is there happening legal. Not that this is the clarifying thing, that we have something adopted. With for me, some of the key elements are that, you know, those who are operating, especially if it's not a primary residence, they have a business license, right? We have a way to kind of track this. That they do the rental inspections, just like we require for long-term rental. I want to make sure we have safe housing for any visitors that are coming into my community. I obviously want them to collect the lodging tax to help support then the evaluation of it. And I do want us to give consideration to, like, where they are. Like, one of my key ones, that designated agent is key for me, because I worry about, you know, misuse of property and having nobody to call on. I don't know what that means, whether or not it's the person who lives there somewhere in town. That I don't know. But for me, that's key for kind of health and safety. But like many here that are in the audience and that are physically on at the table, the idea of having this balance between both, you know, our affordable housing needs and attainable housing is really important to us. We know that. I also know that short-term rentals are not going to be our only way of achieving that, and that we need to build more housing units just in general. We need to make sure we have more houses available for people. And so I think knowing a little bit more of those details on clarifications on how many are taken away from attainable is something. But my baseline is I want to at least have something in process, like, what is it? Are these legal or not legal? And then move on. Mm-hmm. That we're doing. So overall objectives. I'm going to go.
I would say similar objectives. Safety standards and inspections are probably my number one priority. As somebody who has raised their hand and said I've stayed in Airbnb that's been a little dicey, I would like to have something in place to ensure the people that are coming to Columbia are safe when they're here. Collecting the lodging tax, making sure that we have appropriate uses of the property. And I do agree that this is one of several tools that we can use to address the attainable housing stock in our community. We've talked a lot about filtering down of houses from your first-time home buyers to, you know, stepping up and having that filter down. That we're not seeing as much of that right now, and this could be one tool to address that.
And protecting our neighborhoods, I think, is important. I think, and I'll go. I was going to ask this a while ago, so I'll ask it now. I know that we've heard from a number of people. I'm still wondering who we haven't heard from. And I think that for a lot of people who live in a neighborhood, they may not really have a thought about this or a concern about it until an STR shows up next door or just down the street, and they have that experience. Or there's another one that goes in as well, and then they're concerned. So that's a concern I have about who we're hearing from is who we're not hearing from, and that's more difficult to do. I kind of, this whole issue of getting feedback from the community that we want to hear, this is one of those that I kind of like to go into the neighborhoods and do samples and knock on the door and say, can I ask you a few questions? Because my guess is that a lot of people haven't given thought to this, and they probably won't until they have the experience of having an STR. So that's part of the concern there. But the idea is to protect our neighborhoods as being residential neighborhoods. That's what they're, that's how they're designed. It's what they're for. And making sure that we protect that.
Just for me, again, it's, we talk about the regulations. I don't think anybody has an issue with some sort of regulation and inspection. We talked about collecting the tax. Yes, that's certainly the lodging tax. It's something that, you know, if they're staying here in that situation, that's something that we need to be collecting. So by all means for that. You know, the other comments, protecting the neighborhoods. But I also have a concern about, you know, are we making sure during this process that we're also at least attempting to respect the individual property owner's rights?
I think I probably don't have anything different to say than what everybody else has already said. You know, health and safety, certainly, as you point out, for those that have been at Airbnbs, some of them are a little dodgy. And you do want to make sure that if there's a fire, people can get out and that they're not, you know, pulled and cased or whatever. So the health and safety is important. So I think the licensing is important. I'm happy to get a lodging tax, you know, always good to make money if you're the city. And while I do agree that, you know, individual property owners should have some rights, and as a rental person, I certainly have a lot of rental property, I think it's also important that the people next to the folks that have the short-term rental also have property rights too. So I think the idea of having a responsible party and somebody from the city that can enforce this on the weekends and the nights is important, because that's certainly what we see over in my neighborhood, is that, you know, the parties start at midnight and the, you know, and the trash doesn't get picked up. And so the short-term rentals are great until you don't have any responsible party to pick up the trash or to make sure that the lawn is mowed or whatever. So I think we need to be careful that the short-term rentals don't take over the neighborhoods.
I basically agree with most of what it's all been said, so it's like echoing now at this point. But I definitely will put emphasis on enforcement, because fairly enforcing them all, knowing a true system of it, will it be complaint, will it be like in getting that messaging out to the community to make sure that they know, like, in order to regulate, you have to either complain or you have to, whatever the case may be. And will it be anonymous complaints? Because I know some of you are saying that people, neighbors don't want to complain, but if they're anonymous, they get to do it anonymously, then maybe they will feel more comfortable with doing so. Another thing is, I've stayed in Airbnbs where a person was renting an apartment and then they were renting. That, are we aware that people are renting apartments and then putting the apartment on Airbnb?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. We had a very interesting one presented to us the first time we proposed the ordinance. It's a very interesting business model.
We did take that into consideration and allow long-term tenants to rent up to 30 days in a year. Because we also didn't want to say, oh, if you're a tenant, you're out of luck. So we kind of, that's how we tried to balance that. Because we don't want it to be abused.
Do you balance that with the owner's rights?
The owner has to sign off.
Yeah, it's got to be a team.
Yeah.
But that actually is also another way of, it's another tool in the toolbox of maintaining affordable rental housing as well. Bringing in the renter into that process allows them to defer their annual housing costs in one fashion. So that was part of what the commission had identified as a means by which to help in that respect.
So if I'm saying that I disagree with everybody, no.
No.
Absolutely, we need to tax it, regulate it. Safety and affordable housing and protecting our neighborhoods is significant and perhaps the top priorities. I'll just add my own flavor to it, which is really wanting to see simplicity.
Yes.
And I don't say that in terms of picking on P&Z, because I would say that about every single entity within any government body is just simplifying to the greatest extent possible any and all processes. That speaks for itself. I would like to see a serious attempt made at, I know it's not what we're going to call it, but some type of effort of grandfathering in those who have, by our failure, I would say, existed for the last decade plus. When we've knowingly permitted it indirectly, it's not their fault. The city has to take some ownership of that. And then last, I'll add a realistic enforcement, and I mean that from the city's part, and the city cannot be all places at all times, no matter fully staffed or not. We need to be very realistic of what it actually looks like for staff to be doing enforcement and what that result is in the
end. Like the true cost.
Exactly.
Can a clarifying question?
Yes, please. Yeah. When you say simplify, and you don't have to do it right now on the spot, but if there's anything that you can look at other than the secondary residence thing that you would say, this is very confusing and needs to be different, that would be incredibly helpful.
Right.
So, and feel free. I think everyone has my contact information. If not, Pat can get you in touch with me. But
yeah, happy to provide.
We can do it offline, but I would love to hear which parts are confusing, because we are so in the weeds on it. We all know.
Right.
All makes sense.
It all makes sense to you.
It all makes sense to us.
I would hope it does.
Well, I will say, to that point, I think y'all did a good job when you gave scenarios last December. You're like, if so-and-so who does this, this is be the process for.
Right.
I think that's helpful, because a lot of our STR operators, this is their first, some of them it's their first business, right? And so walking through what would the CUP process look like for doing something as they're going into that, I think will be really key for once we get to having something. But we probably need an example before so that they can respond accordingly to any sort of work session that we have with public comment.
And that's probably something we could put together ahead of time to be like, if, especially based on all of the comments we've been getting, some of those folks I kind of wanted to respond to and say, you're actually not a short-term rental. So going through some of that, I think, would be helpful.
That, like, choose your own adventure flow chart was really helpful for me. Yeah.
So then to help you clarify, so you have kind of the council's big objectives for the things that they want to see. You also have the 8 kind of clarifying questions that you wanted to go through.
So staff put these together based on what they've been working on and kind of what they've seen and potentially feedback that we haven't gotten or you haven't
gotten. And I'm going to go ahead and promise you now, you might not get consensus from all 7 of us on each of these 8, but
I'm taking vote counts every time.
Okay.
I'm kidding.
I don't vote in a work session.
We're not voting in a work session. But the direction that we're going.
And that, that is exactly how the questions were intended to be answered. And these are preferencing. They can be yes, no. Questions, obviously, explanation would be helpful as to why a particular approach or question is being responded to in that manner. Again, for clarification within the drafting of the provisions.
And would you reword your first question based on your combining of Tier 1 and Tier 2?
Yeah, so I would say, are you okay with us limiting...
going to jump in, but I will let you answer. I think what Ralph just said is, I think how that would change is the question right now, if it is your principal residence, whether you are the owner of that or a long-term tenant, you will be able to operate a short-term rental in a residential zone. If it is not your principal residence, as it's currently drafted, you have to get a conditional use permit.
Okay.
So I think that's kind of where this question is directed. Are you all comfortable with that scheme? Do you want to see something different?
And I think really 1 and 2 are asking essentially the same thing. Do you want us to limit who can be in residential districts? R1, R2, RMF. Do you want that to look different than commercial? That, I don't think so. We've gone back and forth with legal about doing like neighborhood things, and I think I'll let Becky answer that because.
Yeah, I think the better way to look at this is by if it's appropriate for a zoning district, then it's appropriate for all districts that are similarly zoned.
And Roy, that is actually how the entire code is set up. It is district based. It is not by ward. We actually don't do, there are some provisions within our code that are use-based, which always create a little bit of a different function because you can underutilize commercially zoned property for residential uses. And so we tried when we adopted the Unified Development Code in 2017 to have everything zoning district-based and apply it unilaterally across the city.
I will say downtown has its own zoning district, so it's always treated differently. But other than that, it's based on how you're using the land.
Can I can I clarify really quick? Or it might be something that additional information will be needed. So when we talk about the CUP process, right? And so we're talking about if it's not a owner occupied or a owner
a primary resident.
Thank you. The primary residents of the room for the STR, like, how many are we talking? You know, and like, what is the process for that CUP then? Like, and like, how long does that take? The staff, like, all of those questions.
So, right now, the way that the ordinance is structured, the CUP would only be utilized for a secondary residence, not your primary, but we're consolidating. So that would be transferred basically to a resident wanting more than 120 days. So think about it from that perspective. The number of licensures that's contained within the ordinance right now isn't the subject of a conditional use. It's still the way that this ordinance is structured, which is a question
it's
that we'll get to.
Unit.
It's by unit, and it basically, a licensure is one licensure right now for a short-term rental per property or per property owner, real, I think, natural person, as Sharon refers to it. You only get one license, but there's no conditional use to change that.
Right.
The only conditional use that would exist is really to increase the total number of rental days on that one license.
Well, and if it is not your primary residence and you want to go up to 120 days,
to be honest,
up to 120 days in a residential zone, if it's not your primary residence. But in no case do we allow, over 120 days in residential.
It's correct, but if we, yeah, if you wanted to do over 120 in the consolidated 2 and 3,
if no,
we're going to confuse ourselves here.
And this is, if you are an investor-owned property, if it is not your primary residence,
right,
and you want to be in a residential zone, you have to go get a CUP.
And I can only get one?
You can only get one.
Okay, that's my question. Okay. So they can't get.
But if I have a different LLC, can I get more than one?
No. So this is why the affidavit is so important. You have to sign an affidavit saying that you only have one license and that you are not an owner of any other STR. Every person can sign one affidavit that says that. So theoretically, you could only have one. So even if you create other LLCs, you're still the natural person that has to sign that affidavit. So if you are a member of an LLC that has multiple STRs and you sign that affidavit, you've committed perjury. And that's the easiest way to prevent that sort of loopholing around things, is to be like, no, every human has to sign something saying, I only own one of these. Now, theoretically, myself and my husband could each own one, but that's still way less than what we're dealing with now.
Just to clarify on that one, but in non-residential zone districts, they can be a business and own multiple?
No, they can still only own one.
Unless they were a long-term rental place.
Nope,
and one time they did 30 days or something.
You can still only get one STR license.
Becky, did you want to offer something you're looking at?
That's the way that's currently drafted.
Okay.
So I think part of this process, too, is to see if there is a desire to allow something different.
I want to say probably not. And the reason being that I think that if we want to loosen that later, we can. But what I'm concerned about is that we get to a place where we got it too wide, which has happened in other cities. There's been too much allowances, and then they go back and they say, well, wait a minute, we didn't realize this was going to be the result. I'm guessing that you all have looked at those kinds of examples and learned from them. Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. And I think in R1, R2, R2, these are residential zones.
Yeah.
They're residential zones. What we're talking about doing is allowing commercial activity within residential zones, but on a limited basis.
It's essentially a home-based business, and we regulate home-based businesses all the time.
What if we look at it from the other standpoint? So you have an R1 house that you are renting, and originally as a long-term rental.
Mm-hmm.
So you have your conditional use permit or whatever, your certificate of compliance and all that, and you then switch it to an STR.
As long as it's your only one, and you can otherwise meet the requirements to be in an R1 district, you'll be fine.
How would anyone know?
Well,
again, that's part of the outside entity
yeah.
of scraping.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, when I'm
I mean, if you're asking, like, sorry.
Well, I just wanted to clarify on, forgot who asked the question. It was Roy asked the question earlier about the tenant.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so let's say that a property owner owns six
yep.
long-term rental units, but six different tenants of those. Then do short-term rentals. They're allowed to do that.
Yes,
for
because
30 days.
Yes, because it's not the landowner's license; it's the tenant's license.
Yeah,
but the money goes to the renter.
Yes,
correct.
Right.
Correct.
Right.
So it's not like.
And again, okay. the concept there is it's allowing the long-term tenant the ability to defray their expense to keep the rental. Yep,
yes.
more than 30 days.
On a lease for more than 30 days, yes.
I mean,
and what you won't be able to do is what we've seen with the current setup where someone goes and leases 20 apartments and turns them all into Airbnb. You can't do that anymore because you only get one license. So if you are a student who is here 9 months out of the year and 3 months out of the year, you peace out and your landlord's okay with it, you can rent your apartment for 30 days during that 3 month period that you're not here, or 2 months. Because
asking for a friend, not that anyone ever did this in college, but so was it illegal for them to sublease over the summer?
Subleasing is different.
Okay. I was like asking for a friend.
Yeah.
Don't know what
yeah. Anything, if you have an agreement that someone's going to stay there for 3 months, that's not a short term rental.
Okay.
That's subleasing,
yeah, yeah.
which you also have to get permission, technically.
through your landlord. So, I mean, the idea of a tenant and a tenant's landlord agreeing to that scenario, it's been accommodated in the ordinance, but the actual reality of that happening,
who knows?
We have to wait to see how that plays out. But building that in, the commission believes, as well as we believe, is a method by which to retain rental housing versus having a landlord determine at the end of a 9 month lease, I can make a lot more money by not offering this back to my same tenant who's been on time and payment, has been a great individual.
And I also just want to say, like, at least some of us on the commission view it as an equity issue to say, oh, homeowners can do this thing, but renters can't. So we wanted to have some gateway for renters into this economic activity. And as Councilperson Foster said, we can always expand it. Contracting it will be harder. So let's start with small amounts and we can expand if we need to.
So the example I gave of the property owner owning six properties, he might own a seventh that can be a short-term rental.
Yes.
With this, you know, right? Is that
yeah.
allowed? Like,
yeah, his own. He could
yes.
have his own. He has six rentals and one of his own. His own personal property. He could register his personal property.
Okay.
Yeah.
He couldn't get a CUP to have a secondary residence that is short-term rental.
Not with the way that the ordinance is structured.
Okay.
So, I mean, that's
if he can get if he can otherwise get the CUP, he can get the CUP. The fact that he owns six rental properties whose tenants are also doing STRs has nothing to do with his STR operation.
Okay. You had a question before we...
Just on the CUP, while we're at it, seemed like a good
yeah.
time. Looking at the ordinance draft for it, I had a couple questions on considerations.
Mm-hmm.
There's five of them. I was just curious... I guess my first question, specifically as it pertains to number two and number five, for anybody who's interested, this is on page 9
mm-hmm.
of the draft. Are those similar considerations that we do in other areas where we issue CUPs?
Yeah.
So the whole, the 300 feet
well,
or
so
the getting neighbors' input on that?
The way that planning and zoning CUPs work is different than like Board of Adjustment or something where there's a point system. These are value statement and factors. So It's not that you can't do it if you're within 300 feet. It's that when we're looking at it, it's one of the things we consider. And this is more guidance for the applicant than it is like a checklist, if that makes sense. And we do that on a lot of CUPs. Pat will probably disagree with me, but a lot of the CUPs that come through, there are value statements like these that are attached to it that we are asked to consider in our staff reports and when we're voting.
Okay.
That's what this is for. It's not a, if you can't answer yes to all these, you're out kind of thing. It's more a, when we're looking at it, here's what we're going to be looking at.
Digging into it.
Yeah.
CUPs are very contextual. So short-term rentals in the R, not short-term rentals, accessory dwelling units in the R1 zoning district, for example, are a conditional use. So contextually, when we evaluate, when the Planning Commission evaluates an ADU request in a residential R1 zone, these types of questions similar to this have to be asked because they are assessing the impact of that dwelling unit in that location. Similarly, these questions, which are specifically been developed for short-term rental, would be doing that. Board of Adjustment is a hardship-based process. It is very specific that the hardship has to exist. Conditional uses are not hardship-driven. So these offer an opportunity for analysis to be done that looks at context.
Thank you.
And you will also be considering the general criteria for
Yeah.
Which is based on the comprehensive plan's compliance. And also, just for the newbies, conditional uses, as you probably are aware, start with the Planning Commission, they end with the council. It is almost like a rezoning request, so public input, comments, all are brought forth in that process, which may influence outcomes.
So, to draw us back to the list that staff put together, does the council generally think that making a distinction in the residential districts between who can have one there is wise? Okay.
If we're going with a person can have their secondary property that is their rent, you know, the rental, it's their, I mean, it sounded like you were giving examples that it wasn't too scary. If it was like an investor-owned one as well?
So a secondary home, I guess, that's different from investor.
But it's going away. Currently.
Yeah, now to go away, I think that's the other thing that we have to think about here. When you consolidate Tier 2 and Tier 3,
right,
the concept of secondary or investor property gets blended. So when you look at it from that aspect, Tier 3 then would... Tier 3 becomes more of the commercially operated version. Regardless, the secondary home at that point, we lose all of the secondary residents. A vacation home is what would be the comparable to a secondary residence. So you own a home here in Columbia, you live in Kansas City. And that was the confusion associated with how that's structured right now is why it's being considered for consolidation. If you're an investor, you don't live here. You don't come here, you just bought a home here because you know we've got a hot market and you know you could maybe make money. Now you may live here as well and you may be an investor in the real estate market here locally. So I don't want to offend anybody that they don't live in town. But if it's not your primary residence, the way that these two questions are structured, and I think the question's been answered, if it's not your primary residence, you do prefer to have that regulated in the residential zoning districts versus not having no limitation.
If it's not your primary residence, you have because you it's your primary residence, you have, you can have one by right up to 120 days if you're the owner, up to 30 days if it's your primary residence and you're a tenant. If it's not your primary residence, whether it's your secondary or it's an investment property, you would have to get a CUP in a residential zoning district.
Right.
Get up to 120 days with that CUP.
And to go back to our last conversation, we're still limiting it.
Yes.
Still one per person.
Yeah.
But you are allowing them in residential neighborhoods.
Through a conditional use only, though.
Okay.
Through a conditional use. So that's, I think, the critical elements here. Critical element. Conditional use in residential.
Right.
If it's not your primary residence, max 120 days. If it's your primary residence in a residential zoning district, it's 120 right out of the gate. There's an inspection process and licensure.
But you don't have to come to us.
You don't really have to come through anybody.
So I guess the better question is...
That needs to be updated.
So if we look at this, which
yes.
I like because I can sort of follow it.
Right.
Would we be getting rid of the third one down here then?
We would be consolidating the second and third.
No.
Consolidating the second and third. Okay, so, but for zoning purposes, the secondary residence is allowed in a number of zoning.
Well, and that's why they're asking for clarification on whether or not to add in, almost like, I think it sounds like you're eliminating the secondary residence and then adding the question of whether or not to add the third row for zones R1. You're asking us the question of whether or not to
We're
add
asking it. You the question of, do you want to allow people to have an STR in a residential zone that they do not live in, ever?
And I would say yes, as long as they're only allowed one, which you've already said. I wouldn't think that would be a problem. See, this is why I'm asking for clarification.
Well, and that's to Nick's point of, you know, you're asking, keep it tighter first and then see. Yeah.
But I think if you're only allowed one STR, whether it's in a residential or commercial, that would take care of it, assuming people aren't lying to us, which...
Right. Yeah. Michael, did you have a question?
Just a bit of a reinforcement point. On the CUPs going forward, if you guys look at the chart, it'll tell you under what conditions you can ask for a CUP.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want us to get in the thing of, you know, talked about, you know, about wrap these people in. We won't probably, because it's an administrative idea, be able to CUP every little thing that was not compliant for the next 10 years. So it's probably going to be within the specific parameters as set, you know, in here, unless you all direct us to expand where those little C's go. To Mr. Foster's point, Nick and I had lunch today. It's a great lunch. In regarding to starting small, if you guys want to see some of the negative things that have happened, you can look at New Orleans. They started too big,
mm-hmm.
and then were like, oh my God, no. Then they drew back. They're in court. They've been in court for because it was a there were no giving. They gave and then they took and then they're guilty of a taking.
Yep.
Yeah.
And we can always, I think everyone's 6 months, 12 months, look at these conditions that we've spoke about and go, is it working? Is it not working? Is one okay? Would two be okay?
Realistically, how many?
Oh no, you're good.
Sorry.
No, go.
Okay, realistically, you just gave an example of 6 months, 12 months. Realistically, how many months will we...
We can answer. I don't have that. We don't have an answer to that question. I threw that out as a definitive time frame for us to revisit. And we do not have. We have not discussed that.
No. I think Commissioner Stanton has. First.
Yeah, but I think realistically you're talking at the minimum 2 to 3 years.
Yeah.
And I bring that up from the Unified Development Code that we're supposed to look at 5 years after we passed it. And
exactly.
It takes longer than we think.
Go ahead.
Anthony, you had a thing.
Yeah, I was just going to say, we're absent of any barriers now.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're seeing is the market morphing in, fitting in grooves and nooks and crannies where it can. And now we're to the point where now we've seen how it works unabated, and now we have to adjust to the results of doing that. And starting out tight and being able to give you later always is beneficial. Or we'll have a whole bunch of these meetings trying to fix it.
Okay.
So just recap, just so we're all on the same page. It's questions 1 and 2. We've answered questions 1 and 2. You are okay what we've heard. Bringing you something with a conditional use process for non-primary residents. With the single licensure.
And again, maybe not all in agreement, but yes, bring it forward.
Just want to clarify that. Okay.
I think that probably also answers question three, which is, are you okay with distinguishing between primary residents and non-primary residents?
Oh, that's what you meant by limiting. I was like, it sounds like we're pretty limited. Why would we do that? But now I get you.
Yeah. All right. Okay. So, four then.
So, if you look at some of the results, and this question, as Sharon pointed out, this question comes more from the engagement results to where the total number of day question was answered in a fashion that, at least from staff's assessment of the small sample size that was responding, that the number of days maybe was not nearly as much of an issue to the community. Now, this goes to maybe Mr. Foster's point that who haven't we heard from? Mm-hmm. And what I can tell you is from the first time we did this, since I've been around for all of the activity, we're going to get an even split probably, that anything beyond a weekend is too much, to let's not have any limitations. So the ordinance, as we've discussed up to this point as it's been presented, 30 and 120 days over 120 is basically a conditional use. And now that's not applicable, of course, when you get into a commercial zoning classification where you, in essence, can have a bed and breakfast or you can have a hotel built. So that's generally outside of our residential zoning categories that those day limitations apply. So I think the question here really is, are you comfortable in adding the restriction and adding a day restriction, which again from the research is not an uncommon element, though from the public's response, at least up to this point, it would seem as though it may not need be necessary.
Yes.
This is your one where you're based. Wait, you said the comments.
This
were
is,
like,
yeah, the comments right. were the comments really were the results of the survey.
Most of the actual comments didn't address the number of days. The yes no question is what Pat is talking about.
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
So when you look at that,
yes no.
Do you want us to limit the number of days that you can use a property as a short term rental?
That's what we've been basing it all off of. What the whole conversation has been based on those numbers.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Those numbers sort of sound like best practice in terms of what you've seen in other places. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I think, go ahead, Anthony.
Best compromise after a long battle
would
be better. Everybody brings their research in and we battle for hours and these are the days that kind of everybody kind of had the same.
And we looked at how many football weekends do we have, if you add true false to that, if you add roots and blues to that. I mean, these numbers weren't just pulled out of thin air.
Well, and that kind of gets, you know, we don't have the benefit of your battle, except secondhand, so, which is not uncommon for us. The part of it is, it sounds like you've talked about what do we need these for? You know, part of the argument is that we need, for people who are wanting to do this, is we need to be hospitable. There need to be places for people to stay. You know, I still have this outstanding question about how many rooms do we need at any given time? And I think there's a possibility that the market becomes saturated at some point anyway. I think it was about the Super Bowl and people were raising their costs on their prices for short-term rooms, anticipating this influx that's going to happen. And I think, you know, that's part of it. So that's outside my area of expertise, to be sure. But it seems to me it's part of the equation. So the days, it sounds like that's been part of your equation. How many days do we really need as a community to have these kinds of places available for people to visit?
In the ordinance, the way that the ordinance is structured, so I think the commission in discussing this, and this is maybe more of an internal battle between all of us as we debated the facts, the commercial zoning districts actually don't cap the number of days, whereas part of the commission's underlying objective here was to protect neighborhoods. And so when you look at what the most narrow sphere of 30 days, that actually accommodates all of our football weekends, which was really part of what the underlying impacts were as it was presented the first time around. The third of the year at 120 days is the threshold that the commission arrived at, that once you're operating a residential neighborhood over a third of the year, you're a commercial use at that point, and you really ought not probably be there. And that's where that threshold came from, supported, however, by other ordinances that were evaluated. And I think, anecdotally, in environments where you have high tourism, from what I have been told by industry experts, 90 days may be the maximum that one may need in a high tourism environment. So I think what we arrived at was a number that, as Mr. Stanton said, was a compromise to address maybe that delicate balance. But again, we haven't had everybody come back to us yet publicly and say, this is what we want or not. The original ordinance actually had more days.
We're not talking about the original ordinance.
No, I know.
No, stop doing this to me. Yeah. Stop doing that to me.
No.
We will get so confused.
Yeah, so stop talking about that. I think the question I had is when we're talking about the potential of an additional, you know, the license that you have, and if it's not your primary residence, what happens to that house the other 245 days of the year?
Well, right. And right,
so we're basically saying just get a long-term rental. Just, get, you know.
Essentially, or again, the question is, when we were originally talking about those homes, we're thinking of people where it is their vacation home, or they may teach one semester here, one semester at UMKC, or something like that. So the idea would be that the owner utilizes it the rest of the year in one way or another. And again, I think the idea is that we're trying to minimize the impact on the neighborhood. And if you've got the home empty 5 days a week, and then some new person shows up every weekend, whether it be for 2 or 3 days, that's a disruption in the neighborhood, and we don't want that happening 365. That was our thought anyway.
You, if you wanted to, and I was going to have Don had a question. Could you clarify?
If I may, part of our consideration as to why we need and should allow this commercial use to begin with is that operating an STR in your own dwelling reduces the cost of home ownership or the cost of that renting. So that sort of commercial activity has a positive effect on housing. And so this model was set up so that it would allow someone to live in their dwelling most of their years, most of the days, and rent on days when they're not present. And that's part of, we came at that number from two different directions, right? How much you need to rent to be profitable and how much you wouldn't want to be present in a residential dwelling where it's a accessory use. So depending on the tier that you're looking at, that number might have been calculated differently.
I notice we're at 7 o'clock and we're only halfway through your question.
I know, I'm
so
sorry.
But it's okay. Don, did you have a clear
real quick,
we'll get into the next one.
Do we have data on for Columbia and our short term rentals? What is the average nights rented per year?
I don't think
we do for hotels.
Right. Yeah. No, we're talking short-term rentals.
Okay.
We're talking 30, 120, how many days? Do we have data for Columbia
How
many nights?
Amy Schneider with Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Hi, Amy Schneider, Convention and Visitors Bureau. I do get, it's called Airbnb. It covers Vrbo and it covers Airbnb. So it only covers those two platforms. I looked at it today. Average rent year to date
Right.
But do we know how many
days? 365 days. How many nights are rented?
I do have that information. I don't have it on my on me, but I do have my computer.
We'll be.
Yeah.
Hopefully
not. No, because that, I mean, to me, that's kind of a data point then to, you know, while we're evaluating this. Thank you.
What's that called? Air DNA?
Mm-hmm.
It just sounds so okay.
There's data sources for everything.
Or like a really scary thing. Do you want to go on to your next one? Oh, you
sure. I mean, I guess what's people's temperature, whether it's this 3120, or do you want us to be looking at the number of days at all?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm very torn on that. Because I think there's great arguments for, specifically from the neighborhood perspective, but I also look at it from another perspective of, if we're giving them the license, and we're already limiting it right to how many they can have, where they can have it. I mean, at some point, you might as well just not have it, right? I mean, if you're going to limit it to only 120 days out of the year. I'm torn on that quite a bit.
Okay. Commissioner Stanton, I think.
Mr. Nick, in our ward, it does have an effect. There are Airbnbs that are running 24/7, that affects the neighborhood. It looks like a crack house because the traffic is like that. You see what I'm saying? So, yeah, in our ward, it does have an effect. So, really, we consider looking at that as far as, you know, I'm first ward. So I'm on our side of the fence, it does. And limiting the number and the intensity and all of that is beneficial to our neighbors because we are close to the stadium. We are that thoroughfare to pretty much everything going on downtown. And it would have a terrible impact on us if we let every Airbnb or every short-term rental in our neighborhoods to go willy-nilly full speed 365. I just have to say that.
Commissioner Lowe had one more thought, and then.
I just wanted to amend Kat's statement that we're looking between a weekend and the full week or 30 days. We had commissioners on the commission when we were drafting this that wanted no STRs in their R1 neighborhood.
Yeah.
And I just want you to know that we supported the ordinance as written with the day caps. So this was a compromise. Unanimous. So this was the discussion. I believe we had a very good representation within our
And I think it's a good idea to remind all of us that this will come to council. I mean, it'll go to you all. You will have a work session, or you will have a public hearing. People will come and speak. Amendments will probably happen. It'll also come to council, which we will also have a public hearing, and we can do amendments as well based on the conversations we've had, and we can always give feedback as well. So
absolutely.
I want to make sure we don't get too much into the weeds on some of the things.
Sure.
But
and at the same time, we don't need 14 amendments from the
table. Right.
Like
yeah. Exactly.
Yes.
If the consensus of the council is doing it based on the number of days is not a good idea, and it doesn't matter what we do when we send it to you, you're going to take that out. Knowing that now and being able to think of other ways to limit impact would be really, really helpful. So
I just wanted to point out that on our whiteboard, which we had up during a lot of this, we were very conscious of where bed and breakfasts are and where hotels are. And if you start not limiting those and where those regulations are, and that was part of what contributed to some of the regulations on we didn't want to create a new use that was more permissive than
the
another
existing
use
uses.
Of. Because if we do that, we're going to have to look at those other uses and expand or look at those.
So
and then finally, I just wanted to say, sorry.
Okay.
I think I like the more.
Hey, Betsy, hold on. Nick Foster had his.
Oh, name. Sorry.
Just to me, this goes back to the idea of whether we want to be narrow at this point or whether we want to be broad. I would opt on the narrow side. We can, I think the honest question is that is an appropriate one. How many nights is an individual STR rented. And, you know, starting with where you're recommending or something akin to that, depending on how many more battles you have before it comes back to us, seems like a reasonable way to go.
Do you have a question before we keep going? Okay. So you're, it sounds like, I mean, is there questions about saying no to the 120 days or want to see it included in the draft that they take to their public hearing?
I'm torn.
Well, I guess I have a follow-up statement slash question based on what Sharon said. Was you kind of alluded that there's other ways to potentially address the intensity aspect?
Potentially, I don't know. Okay. I'm just saying if we can't get four votes with days, then we'll go back and figure it out. Because
right.
what I think caused the breakdown last time around was there wasn't a session like this. And so we would make a change, council would make a change, we'd make a change,
right.
Council. And that caused some deadlock.
Yeah.
And so I'd rather know now if people feel strongly about the day question.
I just want to clarify, like, my where I'm torn is, I've heard from probably a dozen, which isn't a lot, but it's meaningful, folks in my ward specifically who use an STR to subsidize their income so that they don't lose their home.
Mm-hmm.
And limiting them to a third of the year, I would imagine, might threaten that.
Okay.
And I'm not saying we should base an entire policy around those, but it's something that's on my mind for good reason, right? Because as somebody else already said, that is something that people do to stay in their home as prices rise, costs rise, electric rates go up. And I worry about taking that empowerment away from them.
And to be clear, this is the number of days you're actually renting it. So you could list it 365 days.
Yeah. But if...
Yeah, no, I understand.
If they want to do 3 days every weekend, right?
If this is going to be a back and forth.
I'm just going to say this.
Okay.
If so, then you need to be long-term. If not, what number would you like? There has to be a win-win.
What I'm going to say. Is it long-term, though, rented to one person?
Yeah.
And that
so
doesn't
you can't do
apply.
That doesn't help,
no.
Right. I kind of just want to say, is our goal to, like, are you guys' goal to, like, ask us these questions so that you can know which ones you need to rework? Okay. And we're not voting on them. We're just giving our opinion of yes and no.
You're doing exactly the way that staff had envisioned this meeting working, which is very helpful.
And you might say something in this meeting, and when it comes back to us, we might have gotten additional input to those people we haven't heard from, and we might say, like, you know, hey, on July 24th, I said this, but now I know that. Like, we are not being, right? I'm assuming, right? We are not being held to, at least I'm not holding myself.
But Sharon isn't.
Sharon is holding.
She may be.
So, yeah, this is kind of just giving them the gist. Which direction I go?
So, four, I think we've got a good idea. We'll pull some information from AirDNA, see if we can't get some other information as well to provide additional background on the
dams. I think Amy has that information.
Yeah, and Amy, we can get it from Amy.
No, I mean she has it now.
Oh.
Okay, what is it? I think this is what you're asking. If I'm wrong, I can get something else. Right now, I show that we have 394 active rentals. This is listed on Airbnb, Vrbo, and then it also shows like where the double listings are on both. The occupancy rate of those 394 is roughly about 60%. So that's about how many are built.
But
still not the
total. It doesn't say on average how many days of a year a single listing would be occupied.
It's all situational, depending on the listing itself being a listing online.
Correct.
It does say average. I can tell you average length of stay is 3 days.
Right. Okay, none of that helps.
And hey, hold on, I don't know you, so Amy was recognized, thank you. And I think this just kind of, the additional data that's probably needed that'll be useful, or information that will help council make the decisions. Thank you, Amy.
Yes, thank you, Amy.
All right, well,
question
we will...
Question five, we've rounded.
Yeah, question five, we've kind of talked around.
Yeah, we've talked around five, six, is a question that we staff came up with. It's a tool that is used elsewhere. However, based on the conversation, the concept of a single licensure and the information that Ms. Schneider just presented at 394. So right now, a cap would be citywide. It's a percentage often is what's shown. We use caps right now for marijuana. We have a cap based on population. Though, as Ms. Sharon and I talked about, you place a cap with a percentage, you almost don't have a limit at that point. So this particular question, based on the conversation that I've heard this evening, I don't think really is relevant at this point. You all have agreed on a single licensure to begin with the opportunity, if we need to expand. So at 400 units, roughly, if you were to open that up to two, you may potentially end up with 800. Obviously, you have some unequal application of owner-operators, and that's the information that Ms. Lowe and Carol pulled together as to we have concentrations of ownership. But most of the data showed when the research was done, as we pointed out earlier, that many folks only have one. And that is, again, another area of how we came around to this licensure, that really you're accommodating the larger group, and there may be some anomalies out there of corporate ownership or folks that just have acquired or converted rental properties. So the cap question's not there. The pathway question has been answered, I believe. We've discussed that, at least that there is, let me ask the question, is there a desire for us to try to identify those that are not capable of becoming compliant in the ordinance structure, a way to do that? And that may have to deal with a couple of different issues. That may have to deal with operation licensures, because we do have several that are operating with more than one. And so, I mean, there is a lot to unpack in that question. And so generally, though, I think is what I think I'm looking for. Maybe law needs this direction as well. Generally, do you want us to examine how to bring existing into the fold?
I almost think it's like that's your way of kind of testing your system as well, right? You have a already known, and you have a working relationship. You're testing the system. They're your pilots for doing it. I mean, you can tell me if I'm wrong, but that seems to be a thing that would be legally okay.
No, I think you're right. I think whatever we come up with, though, that's going to be authorized for currently existing short-term rentals, we also need to be okay authorizing that for any to-be-existing short-term rentals.
Right.
And so we just need to look at that holistically and make sure that whatever we're okay with that is currently existing, we're okay with that moving forward as well for new applicants.
So in other words, we couldn't say, if you're currently existing, you can get a CUP just based on the fact that you're currently existing, because we couldn't, unless we're willing to offer CUPs to everyone, everywhere,
exactly,
all the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Right, but you start.
Yeah. All right.
Or there may be some scenarios that you don't want to have a CUP process for, like maybe you don't want to have a CUP process for more than one STR, or maybe you don't, I mean, again, that is your all discretion how you want to do that, but I think we, at some point, need to have some standards that you know, they can't come forward with any exception by the regulations and ask for that through a CUP process.
All right, well, we'll add that to our to-do list then.
Well, and I want to keep in mind that, you know, what Mr. Sinner said earlier about people inquiring about where we are in terms of regulations, and people might be considered to be grandfathered in, and this is difficult to assess, I'm sure, but came into starting a business knowing it was risky, so it's risky business.
And I will say,
do it that way.
We put a full year before enforcement begins in this draft for many reasons, but one of them is because of this question, because we want to give people time to fulfill the reservations that they already have when this goes into effect, or that when it gets passed. We want people to have time to decide what am I going to do with my property, all that stuff. So, but yeah, we'll add that to the to-do list.
What are your next steps as we've come to your list of numbers? Because you mentioned not doing another public hearing until university session has started again.
It won't be, the earliest would be September. That would be a planning commission public hearing. Mm-hmm. Now, at this point, based on this meeting, the way that I see our activities at the commission level, we meet bimonthly. Normally spend about an hour in work session per meeting. We need to take and we need to digest what we've received here this evening. It is not nearly as significant in the amount of changes that I had anticipated, so I think there's some reworking. Ms. Thompson and I, after our last meeting, needed to discuss, obviously, this concept of consolidating portions of Tier 2 and Tier 3. We will make that as our first effort in our upcoming August meeting, our first meeting in August. Realistically, I would estimate we will not be meeting in September. We will meet in October, and that will also allow us an opportunity to put out for public consumption the draft ordinance that would be being considered. I think we will have to discuss internally if we want to do listening sessions as we did previously before we actually take a final vote. So that may also extend the time out a little bit.
And did you hear as well those examples of helping walk through, especially those new to the process of how this works?
We will have that. I think part of what was discussed when we did the engagement of the questions that were asked, we want to do an FAQ that the public had asked or the comments that have been provided, because as Ms. Sharon pointed out, we ended up with a lot of things that we could have responded to immediately to assuage concerns about this duality of licensure, which we may have addressed a lot of issues. So those, that, the examples, so at FAQ, the examples, and then an ordinance are the three pieces of this puzzle before we can actually have a meaningful, I think, planning commission engagement process through the public hearing, formal public hearings. And what the public also needs to understand is that even following those public hearings, this ordinance may change. And that is just because the comments that are generated may have impact to how we want to approach something. I would suggest that the objective here is to send an ordinance forward to the council that attempts to address as many of the public comments. So when it comes to you, it is an ordinance that will not have the same results as the 2020 version.
I'll say key to that is the listening. Is the listening and incorporating, I think some of the things that we've heard is that, yes, you have a listening session, and then no changes are made, right? And so it's kind of like, well, those people, the comments are probably made, you know, with good intentions. And at the same time, I say on both sides, like, it is best for us to remember at the end of the day what we're trying to solve, right?
Yeah.
To have a process that is legal, safe and healthy for people staying in there, that we are thinking about attainable health within our members, but also opportunities for people to come and visit and stay someplace unique.
And I will say, you know, to that, a lot of times I think that people read the headline and have a knee-jerk reaction, and I'm not talking about us, I'm talking about general public and society at large. And so, you know, I really value the fact that a lot of the comments we got back in this process was very clear that people had actually read the draft.
Yeah.
It was very clear that they kind of understood where we were going. They were still very polarized. You know, some people, in fact, a lot of the comments were, this doesn't go far enough. We should have none in residential areas, period, ever. And then other people were like, you should just let us register and tax us and call it a day, right? So, I mean, I think that we are trying to take on as much feedback as we can. We are trying to make changes where it makes sense. That doesn't mean every comment someone makes is going to be incorporated.
Right. And I appreciate the acknowledgement, and
yeah.
I think we have the same.
Yeah,
for sure.
Oh, I'm sorry, Commissioner Placer.
Yeah, I just wanted to say one word about something that's kind of skipped over, number five, and that has to do with the density of the locations. And I think Nick talked about, people don't realize this, the impact of this, until there's one next door across the street. We had a woman who came to a work session and blurted out, I have five just in my own block, or something like that. So neighborhoods are made up of neighbors. If you have the situation that Commissioner Stanton talked about, where you have constant in and out, or the opposite, if you have, like I have, an empty space where there used to be a family across the street, just sitting empty most of the time. Either one of those conditions has an impact on the neighborhood, on the neighbors, and we have to somehow figure out how to get those people's perspectives represented. I don't know how, but that's not the density, number per block, whatever it is we're going to figure out. We can't have some people being overly impacted.
I don't know how you put that into a thing, you know, especially with the enforcement. I do think the idea about limiting the licenses, hopefully, then might also prevent a bit of that. I will say, I did take major pause with the distance to attractions, because I was like, what's an attraction?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, how to codify that? Like, I think this place is cool. Yeah. What's our, what are we doing? Are we ending? Sorry, we're not having lots. I'm actually like, what's our next steps? If you're raising hands.
Unless people have other final comments, or any of the commissioners maybe want to have final comments, I think the next step is for us to take all this feedback and redo a draft with legal.
And you're going to do your September or October potential public hearing. And then would we do another, or would you just come to us for council public hearing? What's your thoughts?
If you would like, we can present a report, a follow-up report to you once the revised draft has been put together based on these comments, prior to launching whatever engagement, commission engagement process we decide to do through the hearings procedure. I would expect that probably then at the end of September, that we'd have on your second meeting in September a report that just summarizes.
It's a budget. You're going to want to.
That'll be the beginning of October, then. We'll give it to you for the first meeting in October. At that point, then, again, it's all a matter of timing at this juncture.
If we do that, that means that if we do that before we go to public hearing, we're delaying public hearing by another month.
I was thinking it was after
post-public hearing. Okay.
Oh, post-public hearing.
Yeah.
Post-public. I'm writing post and underlining it.
Because, again, those are the additional voices that we want to hear.
And that would be very similar to what we did originally. So we can deal with that.
The big collection of comments. Roy's got something.
It's just a question. Since we have data for how many nights to stay, is there any way to collect data on how many of the affordable rentals, of the FTRs were once affordable housing?
We might be able to talk to Randy and get some of that data.
We could
do it
by census tract zone, which is only going to give us ish. It's smaller than ward, but we have breakdowns for income and housing costs.
But we wouldn't know what was under the housing authority.
Let me ask the question.
I understand it may not be a reliable number, but we don't have any other data for any of that in any way, shape, form, or fashion, and we're speaking constantly about addressing the affordable housing. So having some form of data that at least says, okay, this is the impact that it has had in a book.
We can show you some, and this may be better offline to get into the details of it, but Commissioners Lowe and Carroll did that deep dive into a snapshot to see by census tract where things were at based on income. And that data, we have it, it's a snapshot. Yeah, that was from November of last year. It's in your packet.
So these are census tracts,
with economic data from the census tract on page 3 of the short-term rental data analysis packet. We cannot match it to any sort of definition of affordable housing because we don't have provided to us a very strict definition as to which units could be considered affordable. Our best attempt at this was matching it to census tract data that was done in November of 2022. We picked November because that is a high use for STRs. The next thing that I would like to point out is that limiting, I guess the question of affordability is not the only question that we're trying to address. We're more so trying to address the question of availability, and availability and affordability are definitely, they have some ties, right? None of us can deny this. And I don't think any of us can say, this is the one factor, this is our silver bullet for affordability, everything is unaffordable because of this.
We were actually looking at home ownership more than, not affordable housing was introduced basically in the engagement tool. So we were interested, we being a college town have a low percentage of home ownership, and we were concerned that putting residential on the market for commercial use was going to encroach on that further. So that chart looks at home ownership, population, and income.
And I appreciate including the additional information with us because December was a long time ago.
Yes.
We had the presentation. If there's nothing else, oh, you both put your pens forward. Zach, were you going to say something?
Oh, I was just going to, so first and foremost, new to the commission, so I'm kind of learning as I'm going throughout this process. I know one thing that stood out to me, I don't want to say as a concern, but something I just want to be cognizant of and reiterate to council as well, is that survey data that we were provided, we don't have demographics for, so we don't know if we're talking to homeowners or non-homeowners. We don't know demographics. We don't know a lot of information about that survey data generally. So I know it asked a lot of like support or don't support type questions, and I just want to be very cautious to analyze any positions we may have based on that data, because we don't know who we're talking to, or to Nick's point earlier, we don't know who we weren't talking to either.
If I may, just real quick, in relationship to what he said and what you said, Barbara, and what Nick said, and the experience we had the first time around, there's four of us in the room from back then. There will be individuals who will want to wait to the end to come to you guys, and you guys put in an amendment for them. Could you strongly encourage those people to talk to us first? Because it's that is a negative outcome if that happens. So just ask them to come and say their piece.
I just want to say, I made a joke about your internal battles. And I'm sure that happens within the commission. It happens within the staff as well. Council is dependent on that, from my perspective. I can't sift through all of the things that each of our commissions sift through to the degree and level that you do. This is one reason that I'm so grateful that people bring themselves forward to serve on our commissions. So thank you to each of you for the intensity of your work and longevity of your work. And also thanks to staff who have been doing that work also, of course, in a major way on a daily basis. I just want to say a word of thanks and appreciation for that. I've won again.
Anything else for the good of the group? Anything else you wanted to discuss or address?
No, just emphasizing again, the goal here, the goal of this session, and the reason that we keep giving you reports and reports is so that we don't have to have this recommitted to the commission. We'd love it if we get through this process and we're all on the same page and we don't have to have more than one vote, right?
All right, well, I'll go ahead and adjourn us. It's 7:29.